Okay, so let us continue roughly where we left off yesterday. So this morning we're going to have a look at a sutta called the Potalia Sutta. And Potalia is a layman who wasn't a Buddhist. He was just kind of one of these people who thought he was a kind of holy man, but he was wandering around and then he meets the Buddha on one of his wanderings. And he says to the Buddha that I have cut off all my worldly affairs, everything in the world. I have just given rid of all of that. And I have, I've kind of become a holy person as a consequence. And the Buddha points out that there are things that he hasn't cut off. And as part of this, he gives these similes, seven similes about sensual pleasures. And he points out the kind of the disadvantage and the problems that arise with sensual pleasures. So now we're still dealing with the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, how to kind of use our mind in a wholesome way to overcome the defilements and overcome problems, and to sort of ready the mind for meditation practice, for sammasati, satipatthana, and eventually samadhi itself. So it's all part of that, and although it is true that the most important things to overcome as part of this practice is the ill will, I think it's also useful to have a little bit of a look at the sensual pleasure side of things, just to get the Buddhist idea, the Buddhist view on this, why it is problematic, why it is better to kind of gradually move away from that and move in a different direction. This is really what this is all about. And so this is not meant to kind of for anyone to sort of push these things aside or to repress them or suppress them in a harsh way. It is just a way of reflecting, and that reflection in itself will tend to have in the long run at least certain effects on your mind, and you will start to move your mind in a different direction to think about these things differently. So it's not kind of take some drastic actions in this area. It's just more a way of thinking about things. And then things happen usually as a matter of course from there. So the word for sensual pleasures in Pali is kama, not kamma. Kamma is action. Kama is sensual pleasures. And this word has two different meanings, as I mentioned the other day. One is the personal feeling of desire, right? A desire, the things of the world, whatever that is, the five senses. So it's a very broad thing. It almost includes everything we do on a daily basis as part of this world of the five senses, because our senses are almost operating pretty much nonstop all the time. But it also means the actual objects of that world, the things that we desire. Not just the actual desire itself, but also those things in that world that we are trying to kind of to get hold of or appropriate or attach to or desire. So all of those things, whatever it is that we like to see, to feel, to hear, etc., is part of that. And this is important to understand. And that's why we had that question the other day about the person who wanted to rearrange the furniture, right? You want to rearrange your furniture. It doesn't sound like it's part of the karma of sensuality, but it is, because it's part of that world of getting things right for yourself, being comfortable, getting things kind of so it is just right. So it is actually part of that world. It's a very broad part of our personal experience. And for that reason, it is quite challenging to move away from that and move towards the more spiritual aspects of life, the mental happiness, the mental pleasures, and these kind of things. So let's see what the Buddha has to say to this man, Potalia. And these similes, I always found them very powerful. Initially, when I read the sutta, I didn't really know what to make of them. But over time, it became more clear to me anyway. At least my own interpretation of these things became fairly clear. So this is what happened. So again, it's just an extract. It's the middle of the sutta. And this is what the Buddha has to say here. Householder, and Potalia is really upset, right? This is part of the sutta as well. He's really upset because the Buddha calls him householder. I'm not a householder. I've cut all these things off. He's not really happy with that. So anyway, householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, the sensual pleasures are compared to this dog, right? And the sensual pleasures here is this bone that gets thrown to this dog. And the dog is really kind of running around, finally getting to the shop, looking for the pleasures in the world. Comes to the butcher shop, waits outside. And of course, there's no way that butcher is going to toss that dog some real meat, because that meat is expensive, especially at that time in those days. It would have been very kind of luxury thing. And the dog waits and waits, and then it finally gets this bone, and it kind of gets the taste of those sensual pleasures. But it's only a taste. There's no real satisfaction there. It doesn't fill the dog up. It doesn't feel there is no real end to that hunger. And that's what it says here. It doesn't get rid of the hunger or the weakness. It doesn't change anything really, apart from craving re-arising pretty much straight away. And because craving re-arises straight away, that dog, poor dog, runs off again, right, in search of more sensual pleasures to the next butcher's shop, and again waiting outside, and the same thing happens again. Again, it just gets this meatless bone smeared with blood. The taste is there, but no real satisfaction, no real contentment, no real happiness, no sense of fulfillment. All of these things are missing. And then it keeps on running and running and running, and never learns. And that's the problem with being a dog. A dog, you don't have much chance for learning these things. You just haven't got those faculties to learn. And sometimes human beings are a bit like that. We don't really learn. And then one of the reasons we don't learn is because we haven't got anyone to point these things out for us. It's actually hard to see. Once you see this, it kind of becomes obvious. This is what our lives are like, right? We run around. We run from one thing to the next one, always seeking something else, always thinking that the next time around we're going to be happy, it's going to be complete, going to be contentment with these things. But it never really works out. There's always more craving rising up just behind the previous one. That relationship is never as satisfying as you thought it was. And even if it is satisfying, then you die, and then you have to start over again in your next life. Again and again, doing the same thing. No sense of final satisfaction, no sense of completion is really there. And why is that the case? What is actually going on here? And one of the things that is going on is that it's almost as if we have a hole inside of us, there's a psychological problem, a psychological lack of contentment, a psychological lack of completion and satisfaction. And then we try to fill that psychological problem with external things. We run around in the world trying to fill up a lack inside of us with external things. That psychological lack can never really be filled up by external things. You get the external thing, you feel a little bit of satisfaction, but soon enough that lack inside of you, it comes back again, and then you have the same problem once more, and that's why you keep on running around for the next thing. And every time you do that, the craving tells you the same thing. If you follow me, just listen to that voice of craving inside. That voice of craving usually says, if you get this, you will be satisfied. That is the feeling we have. And because that is the feeling we have, we run after these things again and again and again. And we never really learn the lessons. And part of the problem is that we don't really see any other way. It is not obvious that there is any other answer to this. And that's why it takes a Buddha, it takes somebody who has a deeper insight to show us that there actually is an alternative way. And that is to work with your mind directly, to work with your psychology, to work with your psyche, so as to fill in that gap from a personal, directly, immediately inside of us, instead of seeking for that happiness outside. And that is the path of Buddhism, that is the spiritual path, is to feel that sense of satisfaction inside, the sense of contentment inside. So you don't have to seek it in the world outside through the five senses. And this is what this path is about. And this is when you do something, when you live the spiritual life in the right way, you practice kindness, you start to feel a sense of contentment and happiness inside of you. And that happiness is of a very different kind than the external things that we're always seeking for. That sense of happiness inside is immediate. It hasn't got anything to do with craving. It's not really driving you on into the future anymore. It's here and now. You feel content here and now because you have done something good. Yeah, it has nothing to do with desire, and that is why it fills you up. You feel satisfied for the first time in your life. And as you keep on practicing the spiritual path, you do this more and more through living well, through acting in a kind and compassionate way. Eventually, this builds up and builds up and builds up. And one day you sit down in meditation and you feel the meditation is going deeper and deeper. And as it goes deeper, the mind becomes more and more still, less and less craving, less and less desire, until eventually you reach a point where desire is completely gone and you feel completely satisfied in the present moment, completely content. There's no more, you feel complete. The itch that driving you forward from one thing to the other one is completely disappeared in your life for the very first time. And it feels like, at that point, it feels like you have attained, you have reached, in a sense, the meaning of life. Because this is the thing that craving was always pointing you towards the sense of satisfaction. You could never get it, because externally it was impossible to fill that psychological hole inside of you until one day you go in a different direction and you think, wow, this is it. I found what I was looking for all along. And the sense is that you have found the answer to the meaning of life. You feel completely satisfied. And you know that because when you get to that point, you don't want to get up anymore. You just want to sit there. And you can sit there, just bliss out until eternity itself. And you will be completely happy with that. You're content, right? That is the meaning of contentment. There's no drive anymore. There's nowhere else to go. There's nothing more to be done. And that is the promise of the spiritual path. And that is why this practice really is the answer to the meaning of life. And that itself is not even the final goal in Buddhism, because what happens, of course, is that you lose that state again. And then you need to also have insight to make these things much more permanent. Yeah, but essentially that is where the solution to everything lies. And you find it there. So this is a very beautiful simile to me, it's one of the most powerful similes of these similes here, because it makes it very clear what the problem is, and it can also understand, I think, where the solution is. Now, one of the big problems here is that this very act of following your desires, or running from one butcher shop to another one, running from one sensual pleasure to another one, always pursuing these things. Attachment to the sensual world is a very important part of this. But one of the big problems with this is that this is the main thing that attaches you to samsara, to the endless running along, going from one life to the next one, getting born, getting old, dying, and doing this, going on and on and on, doing this almost forever into the future, and certainly stretching back into the past. This is the most powerful thing that binds us to this samsaric existence. When you crave, you're always looking at the future. And that very fact that it's always about the future, it's as if you are projecting yourself into the future. And for that reason, it keeps you going, keeps you tied to this kind of to this whole process. And this is, I think, this is the most of course, the desire for existence itself is also part of this. But the most basic and most powerful thing that is hardest to overcome on the path is this desire for sensual pleasures. So it ties us down. This is in large part responsible for the whole problem that is samsaric existence from the Buddhist point of view. A very powerful tie that ties us down to this. And for that reason, it is one of those very important things to reflect about on the Buddhist path. This is also why, as monastics, you live a celibate life, right? You live it because it kind of drives you towards the giving up of these kind of pleasures and moves you in a different direction instead. So that is this simile of the dog that is never really satisfied. And one of the other things about this, which is interesting, of course, is that we tend to identify with the craving. It's almost as if we are the craving. The craving is us. We identify with that. And one of the reasons why we identify with craving is because we identify with being the doer. I am the doer in my life. I'm the agent. I'm the one who kind of sorts things out and gets things done. And because you identify with agency itself, you also identify with craving very often. So, of course, if you identify with the craving, it means it's hard to overcome, because that is who you are. And you feel personally challenged if you kind of have to abandon this. You feel, I am disappearing. What's going to happen to me if there's no craving? I'm not there anymore. And that's why this path is a gradual path of gradually, first of all, identifying with other things, identifying with a kind of peace and happiness of meditation, of living well. And then as you gradually identify with that, identity itself gradually disappears as you practice this path. But it's strange. It's actually from the suttas. The end. Most of the things I quote is most of the things I say is actually somehow based in the suttas, one way or another. And this idea of identity with craving is actually straight out of the suttas, and the Buddha. So this is part of the Buddha's words. So there you are. That is the simile of the dog. And please reflect on these things as they appear in your own life, because I think we all have some. We should all be able to kind of see how these things actually relate to our own life. There's a tendency that craving always comes back up again. It is never really satisfied. It takes new objects. Sometimes it moves from one sense to another one. But it always re-arises. It never is really satisfied in any profound and final sense. The final satisfaction is found in a completely different place. We have to look somewhere else, and there we can find this real satisfaction in life. Okay, let's go move on to the next simile here. Householders, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then other vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat? Wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, piece of meat is the other sensual pleasures. And then you have this idea of fighting over the sensual pleasures. Yeah, you finally get hold of something, and then somebody else comes and says, I would like that too. Yeah, like the kind of classic thing is that we are competing over relationships, right, over the same partner. That is kind of one of the typical things in life. But it's not just that. It is kind of much broader than that as well. There is only, the economic pie is only so big. And then you have, you know, you have all these billionaires on the one hand, and you have lots of poor people on the other hand. Yeah, and we're kind of fighting over limited resources. And this is one of the problems in humanity. So that it's kind of fighting. People, you know, the last generation come to the end of life, and you fight over the inheritance, or you fight over whatever it is. There's a lot of this kind of competition going on in the world. And so what this shows us is that inherent part of sensual pleasures is also the idea of ill will. Ill will comes together with sensual pleasures. These two things cannot be entirely separated from each other. And this is interesting because, yes, we emphasize the idea of giving up ill will and negativity on the Buddhist path. And you can go a long way with that, but you can never really completely let go of that as long as you are in the world of sensual pleasures. Because sensual pleasures are about external things. And external things are what we have in common. Because they are what we have in common, there's bound to be some clash in the world as long as we are pursuing those things. And it says elsewhere in the suttas, it specifically talks about this. It talks about the whole chain of causality, whereby you start with craving, and because you crave, you grasp onto things. You have the sense of ownership. This is mine, and then you guard it because it's yours, right? You know what it's like if somebody robs your house? It's not very nice, because it's your stuff, right? It's unfair. They can't take my stuff. So, and because of that, then you guard these things, but still you lose them. Still, the government, the kings and the robbers come, and you fight with other people, brother with brother, father with son, mother with daughter, all these kind of things, as it says in the suttas. It always leads to problems, the world of sensuality, the world of sensual objects. And that is very different from the spiritual happiness, because the spiritual happiness is internal to each one of us. In fact, the spiritual happiness is derived from the exact opposite principle. The spiritual happiness is derived from when we cooperate with others, when we are kind with others, when we work together, not when we compete, but actually from the exact opposite. So the spiritual happiness is, instead of actually driving us to fighting with each other and ill will, it tends to lead to the exact opposite thing in the world. More harmony, cooperation, a sense of unity, a sense of looking after each other, a sense of care. And then when you sit down in meditation, you then get the happiness that comes from that. And it's purely internal to yourself. There's no competition anymore. That kind of happiness that never leads to ill will. In fact, it is the precise opposite of ill will, and that's why it works. So this is, I think, a very interesting problem with sensual desire. It is always tied up with ill will, always tied up with problems, with competition, with a sense of disharmony, right? It is almost impossible to live in that world without that disharmony. And that is why, you look at humanity, and that is why there's always going to be some degree of problems, I think, in the human realm, precisely because of this. There is no such final solution in the human realm, precisely because as long as we are attached to sensuality, and we will always be attached to sensuality, because that is why we get reborn as humans. Otherwise, we would reborn somewhere else. So it is the nature of this realm, that is the nature of it, is that there's going to be disharmony and problems. So let's have a look at the next simile here. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch? Wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his arm, his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the blazing grass torch, right? The point of a grass, of a torch, is to give you a bit of light, and that is the kind of the pleasure there. So you get a bit of happiness and pleasure because you can see where you are going, and that is the happiness of the sensual pleasures. But also, it quickly turns out to be a problem. So what is the problem here? And one of the problems, of course, is that wherever there is desire, there is attachment just behind the desire. There's no such thing as desire and craving without attachment. Because attachment is just what we do. If you have desires, you want to control that world. And our way of trying to control the sensual world is by attaching to it, holding on to it, appropriating it, making it your own. This is my relationship. This is my husband. This is my wife. This is my partner. These are my children. This is my house, my furniture, my identity, my career, my religion, right? We attach to all of these kind of things. But the moment, so this is just how we try to control that world. So wherever there is craving, there's a trying to control, which is the attachment, the upadana, tanha pachaya upadana, craving leads to the taking up and holding on to things. And that then becomes the upadana pachaya bhavo. That upadana taking up then conditions existence. We exist in accordance with that. And so, of course, once you attach, once you exist in a certain way, then that existence, that attachment will be challenged. It will be challenged by the nature of reality, which is unreliable, impermanent, cannot control. Yeah, and that's what happens when you, because that challenge is always there. You attach to those, you attach to things that are inherently unreliable, uncertain, subject to change. Then, of course, you're going to suffer as a consequence. Because it's just impossible. You're attaching to something that cannot be controlled, that will not always be there, that is inherently unreliable. And because of that, bang, you are going to suffer when that happens. And this is part of the problem. So whenever you crave for something, you're basically saying, allow me, please allow me to suffer, because that is the consequence of that. And also important to remember as well that desire is, the more you see desire for what it actually is, or craving for what it is inherently unpleasant. It is inherently unpleasant because it is restless. It is agitated. It is not a state of peace. It is inherently hot. It is inherently, it's basically not a very nice state. And the more you move towards peace of mind and the clarity of meditation and those kind of things, the more you can see the inherent problem in craving and all of these things. Please notice that. This is one of the things you can notice, at least to some extent, on a retreat like this, because you are now going in a different direction, hopefully, from what you normally do. So that is the blazing grass torch. Yeah, a little bit of happiness. And this, of course, is the point, an important point on the Buddhist, again, understanding, is that it is not as if sensual pleasures are entirely painful and problematic. There is some degree of happiness there, because if there was no happiness, we wouldn't even go there in the first place. It's precisely because there is some degree of enjoyment that we go there. So you have to kind of compare the enjoyment and compare that to the disadvantage. And that is really what we're doing here. Okay, now comes the next one. This is a really powerful simile. And let's just read it out first of all. Householders, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this is one of those really strong similes in the suttas, so strong that it's almost hard to understand how that can be the case. How can sensual pleasures be a charcoal pit? All these beautiful, nice, sensual things in the world, you're just enjoying yourself. It is kind of, you know, beautiful sights, nice music, nice relationships. How on earth can this be called a charcoal pit? It is what life is all about, isn't it? That's what most people think. And here the Buddha kind of goes so against the grain. This extraordinary, powerful simile here. And one of the things here is to remember that you don't just take this on board and say this is the absolute truth. It is here for you to contemplate and to think about. There is always going to have to be some degree of faith and confidence in these kind of things. So you look at them for what they are. You don't kind of reject them because it just sounds too much. But you look at them for what they are and see, maybe if the Buddha says so, maybe there is some truth to this, even though it is hard to really comprehend straight away. And the way that the Buddha explains this, and I haven't actually included the sutta here, maybe I should, but this is explained in a sutta also in the Majjhima Nikaya 75. It explains exactly how this works, how it can be the case that something which seems so pleasant, seems so nice, Actually, it turns out, on inspection, when you look at it carefully, turned out to be the exact opposite. And the way the Buddha explains this, he says that it is the simile of the leper is what this is all about. And some of you will have heard this before, but it's a very, very nice simile that explains this quite well. And the simile of the leper is that if you have leprosy, you have all these wounds over your limbs, right? Your fingers, your hands, or whatever. And apparently it can be very, very incredibly itchy. Sometimes you have worms and things in those wounds, and extraordinarily itchy and very, very unpleasant. So because it is so itchy, as a leper, you will go to a flame, to a charcoal pit, and you will, it says, cauterize, which basically means like burn. And you will burn your hands and burn your limbs over that charcoal pit because it feels better. Yeah, it feels nice. The itch is so incredibly unpleasant that it feels nice to burn yourself over that charcoal pit. And then, of course, the simile is that then that leper, he goes to a doctor. And then the doctor kind of fixes them up, gets rid of that bacteria or whatever it is that causes the leprosy. And then they are okay. They don't have that itchiness anymore. They are fine. And the Buddha asks this person, this Magandhya. Magandhya is one of these people. He's a wanderer, but he's a wanderer who praises the sensual pleasures, right? So he kind of strange kind of wanderers they had in India in those days. Very different from what we think of these days. But anyway, so he goes and he says to this Magandhya, I said, well, Magandhya, now that the leper is healthy again, he doesn't have an illness, would he still go to the charcoal pit and burn his hands over those flames? And of course, Magandhya says, no, of course not. And then the Buddha says, and this is kind of the punchline here, it is exactly the same thing with sensual pleasures, right? We go and we burn ourselves in the fire of sensual pleasures. And then one day we overcome sensual pleasures. We go into a deep state of samadhi, or we abandon the sensual pleasures completely through insight. And then there's no way we would want to go back to the sensual pleasures again. Why? Because we have found something far superior. We are healthy. Our minds are no longer distorted. Yeah, the Buddha says to Magandhya, the reason why he went to that flames in the first place, because he has a distorted idea of what is pleasant in the world. You don't really understand where true happiness is. And that's why you go and burn yourself, cauterize yourself over those flames. That's why we go and burn in the sensual pleasures of the world, right? And we burn there and we feel hot and we crave and all of these kind of things, but because there is no alternative, because we don't see that there is an alternative, that is why we keep on doing that. So this is how the Buddha explains this, and hard, difficult to really grasp for the vast majority of people, hard to see. We can maybe see a little bit of this, but only a tiny amount. So you just think, okay, well, the Buddha says so, maybe there's something to this. Let's practice this path and see where it leads us. And then maybe one day you will see those things. Okay, there you are. So this is why the Buddhist teaching can be kind of challenging sometimes, right? They can be kind of, they're really out there. They're really different from how we normally perceive the world. And this is why this is what makes them so interesting in many ways. Because what they are promising you is obviously something very beautiful. If they see the sensual pleasures as so problematic, then what they must be promising you is something far, far more happy. And this is kind of also what makes them so interesting and so attractive in one way. Because they're actually promising you a degree of happiness that is far beyond our ordinary experience. And this is the implication here. It's important to remember those implications of happiness, of contentment, that is part of this. Okay, so there you are, the simile of the charcoal pit. Next one. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes. And on waking, he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, and this is what sometimes you hear, right? The world is a bit like a dream. right? We kind of walk around in this dream, and then one day you wake up to reality, and you see things for what they actually are. And here you have the Buddhist equivalent of that, the idea that you kind of, the world is a bit dreamlike, there is no real sense of reality to it. And one of the ways to understand that is that in the world we because of craving, we're always really looking at the future, always looking at something else, something which hasn't really arrived yet. And because that is what we are craving for, it's a bit like a dream. We live in this dream about the future, dream about what things can be like, a satisfaction that is always kind of slightly above, beyond the horizon. Beyond the horizon, that's where real satisfaction lies. And then you get there, and there's another horizon. It's like this mountain behind the mountain behind the mountain, always kind of moving on. This is the dream of life. And if you think about that, I'm sure you're able to relate to that to some extent. Very difficult to really live in the present moment, always looking to the future for something else. This is true both in the small picture of the daily small cravings we have, and also the big picture cravings, the big ideas that we have about what life is going to turn out to be like in the future. And I always like my own experience with this, because I remember when I was young, I was having ideas about what kind of girlfriend I was going to have. Right? Look at me now, I kind of failed miserably, right? Or what kind of house I was going to have. I'm going to really, really have a really nice house. Please have a look at my cutie in the monastery. The tiny little thing. Actually, that cutie in the monastery is far preferable to any big house you can have. One of the horrors for me is to go into Perth and see these big mansions, these enormous mansions sitting there on the riverfront, right? And they have about half a meter between each other here, because the property value is obviously so high there that you maximize and you build a massive mansion on these tiny little properties. But for me, the space I have around me, the kind of feeling of the forest, far more important than the size of the place where I live. In fact, the size is just a hassle. Whereas all the nature around it, that is what makes it feel peaceful, makes it feel secluded, gives you all those beautiful feelings of living the spiritual life. So I'm horrified when I see those big mansions. I think that looks terrible. I never want to live in any one of those things. So again, it shows you your dream and the reality is so different. When you're young, you're always very arrogant. You think you're going to have this wonderful career and everything is going to be really, you're going to be all these kind of things, right? And of course, it turns out so absolutely different from what life really is like. In my situation, probably quite extreme, the difference. But for all of us, it is different, right? For all of us, very different from what we think it's going to be like. The ideas we have when we're young and the reality as kind of time goes on is always we are far too optimistic about what the world is going to be like. And then we kind of have to tone it down a bit. And then again we get it wrong. So again we have to change our ideas. But we never really learn. We keep on thinking about the future. We keep on thinking that things are going to be somehow be different one day. We're going to get those things that we're really searching for. And of course then one day in the meantime, what happens? We die, right? That's what happens in the meantime. And because we are still driven by that craving, then when we get reborn, we continue kind of following along with roughly the same dreams as we had in the last life. And we keep on dreaming like this, from life to life to life, never really getting out of that, always forgetting in the meantime that we made exactly the same mistake in the last life, so we keep on making the same mistake. And we keep on running after things that we never really get, that never makes us satisfied, never really give us any satisfaction. You can see the problem in that. It's really, after a while, it's kind of terrible almost. It really turns you off. It makes you feel, it makes you, I guess eventually it makes you reject that whole thing. It makes you feel repulsion and aversion to this whole idea of running after something that you never actually get. You never get there. And that is why then you start to move on to the spiritual path instead. And you search for the happiness which comes here and now. And this is the powerful thing about the happiness of the spiritual path. Because it is here and now, you're getting out of that dream. The dream is no longer there. You actually become present. You are mindful. You are happy in the present moment. You gain a happiness which is immediate instead of something which is always related to craving, always kind of somewhere slightly over the horizon, slightly out of reach, moving towards something all the time. So this is this beautiful simile of the dream. And I think, again, it's something that I'm sure all of you can relate to some extent. Then we have the next simile, which I also like quite a lot. And it goes as follows. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Yeah, sensual pleasures here means the objects of the sensual world, all the things that we kind of grasp and we hold on to and we attach and that we think we own. We think we own them, but that, of course, is just a delusion. We don't really own them because ownership implies control, and our control over these things is limited. Eventually, they will be taken away from us. Nature will come and grab them and rip them away from us, whether we want to or not. We have no choice in the matter. And that is why they are borrowed goods. You can only have them for so long, and then they will be gone. So remember that. Very often, fact that they are borrowed, the fact that they will be taken away from you, will happen before you die. But at the very latest, these things will come when you die. When you pass away, all of these things of the world will have to be given up. And so much of the things in our life that are that we hold on to belong to this world, right? So much. When you start to kind of count things up and you start to add it all up, you realize that the vast majority of things in our lives actually are borrowed things. And you start counting it, right? So obviously, first of all your belongings, that's very obvious. You can see that you're going to have to give it up. All our relationships, the friends, families, the people who are the closest to us, all of that is going to have to be given up. These are kind of the obvious things, right? Your physical body, obviously, right? The body that you look after so much, you go to the gym, you do the workouts, you do everything, right? After all that hassle with it, with this body, making sure it looks just nice, then gone, right? Just a pile of ashes remaining. That's all that's left of that body that you look after so much. That body goes. Then all the mental possessions that belong to this world, all your status, your education, your career, your successes, your sense of identity is so much tied up with things in this world. All of that too will have to go, right? There's almost nothing left. All that is left really when you die, and this is what we will see later on today, is of course the idea of the mental things that you have developed, the karma that you have built up for yourself. In other words, all the mental happiness, all the goodness of your heart, the kindness, all of these things. In other words, the qualities of the mind, that is what you take with you into the future. And the powerful thing with this simile is that it shows us where we should really invest our time and our resources. Life is so short. Before you know it, it comes to an end already. You know, if you're lucky, you stay on this planet for 80 or 90 years. If you're not so lucky, it's less than that. You just don't know when it's going to come to an end. But regardless, it's very short, this lifespan. Yeah, when I think about it, I think it was only yesterday, like I was 20 or 25. It just disappeared, kind of in between there somewhere. So it is so short. So how much of your time, how much of your resource, how much of your energy are you going to invest in something that is about to disappear? It's only a matter of time, it will all be gone. Yeah, and it's kind of madness the way most people live their lives, where everything is invested into this life. And imagine when you invest everything in this life, and then you die, you're on your deathbed. How do you feel? You feel confused. You feel, what happened? What was the point of all this? I built up all of these things in my life. I'm so proud. I built up a career. I kind of done all of these good things. You feel really proud of your life, and I've kind of supported the family, and kind of my children are doing well. And now I'm going to have to go. What was the point? It all seems so pointless, so terrible. You've done all of this stuff and you have to give it up. And this is why people, sometimes when they live like that, they die, they are confused, they're holding on, they can't let go, because your entire life has been involved with those things. So of course, then you realize, if you are smart about this, if you get the Buddha's teachings in time, if you're lucky enough to be reborn in Perth in Western Australia, so to get these teachings right, then you realize, wait a minute, what I should do, I need to change my investment strategy. Instead, I need to invest in those things I can take with me into the future. Invest in my mind. Invest in those things that bring true satisfaction that I can take with me into the future. Then when you die, you don't feel confused anymore. Then when you die, you feel a sense of clarity, because you know that you're taking all that goodness with you into the future. You know you have invested in the right way, and you take that, take those qualities with you. So this, to me, is a very powerful simile, and it also shows you the importance of having this idea of rebirth in Buddhism. It changes things so dramatically. Yes, you still want to live a spiritual life if you don't believe in rebirth, because that believes that leads to happiness in this life. But this kind of changes the equation enormously when you look at things in the big picture, life to life to life, the equation, the kind of interest in expanding your view becomes so obvious when you do that, when you look at things differently. So be careful. Don't just focus on this little life. If you focus on this little life, we end up our life and we just don't know what happened. We feel confused and we feel attached and all these kind of things. Expand your horizon. See reality for what it actually is. And this is one of the reasons why this idea of rebirth is like breaking out of the eggshell. Whoa, this is what it's like. And it changes your entire attitude to things. It changes your outlook. And you start to think of the world in an entirely different way. And also you live your life differently as a consequence. So that is the idea of the borrowed goods. So again, I think it's a very useful way of thinking about life. And another one that is quite easy to understand, that we can all relate to. And that is one of the advantages of that particular simile here. Okay, let's have a look at the last simile here. Householders, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove, and saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. What do you think, householder, if that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here we have this man who enters the grove, and this grove for me means like the world of sensual pleasures, right? You enter the world of sensual pleasures. Perhaps it means you get reborn in the human realm, or perhaps some deva realm where there's lots of sensual pleasures. And when you enter that grove, you kind of wander around in that world, looking at these trees, looking out for sensual pleasures that you can enjoy, that you can attach to. Yeah, you walk down, like walking down the shopping street and looking at all, in all the windows, and to see what can I perhaps enjoy in this world of sensual pleasures. And then you come to this tree, right? This tree here, this department store, perhaps, or whatever it is, and you climb up the stairs, and you go into the escalator, you climb up the tree here, and when you go into that tree, you find all these fruit, right? All these sweet mangoes in that tree here. And then, when you find the sweet mangoes, everybody likes mangoes, I think. I've never heard of anyone who doesn't like mangoes. It's kind of a universally liked fruit. So you climb up the tree and you, whoa, this mango is so nice, just ripe, just perfect. And you sit there and you really kind of get completely indulging in those mangoes. And because you are indulging in them, you lose your mindfulness, you lose a sense of reality, you get intoxicated. Yeah. And this is what happens here. Sensual pleasures are intoxicating. Yeah. This is one of the characteristics of sensual pleasures. And because they are intoxicating, you lose your sense of reality, your sense of mindfulness. This is the problem with alcohol. When you drink too much, you lose your sense of what is right and wrong. You get intoxicated. And because you are intoxicated, that is why you do crazy things when you are drunk. I remember being drunk myself. It's a long time ago now. It's not after I became a monk, just to make that absolutely clear. It's a long time ago. But when I was a university student, sometimes I did really stupid things. I remember back. And that's okay. I don't mind having done some stupid things in my life. But if you lose your sense of what is appropriate and what is kind of proper when you get really drunk. And this is part of the problem. But drunkenness in the Buddhist teaching is not just alcohol. You can get drunk on so many things. And one of the things you can get drunk on is sensual pleasures themselves. And you forget what really matters in the world. And that is why we tend often to break precepts if we are too attached, have too much craving for sensual pleasures. Because they promise us happiness somewhere else. And we follow that. We're pulled by the nose towards these sensual pleasures. And we forget what is appropriate. And this is what is happening to this man. He's sitting in this tree, intoxicated, indulging in sensual pleasures. He's not aware that kind of his death is approaching. This is the grim reaper coming at the bottom there, right? And kind of cutting down the tree. And as he cuts down the tree, if you don't come down quickly, if you don't regain that mindfulness very fast, the tree will fall over. And then you have a serious problem because you are sitting in the top of that tree here. So this is how I interpret this particular simile. Again, these similes probably can be interpreted in different ways, some of them. But that is the way I look at that one. We are in that jungle, intoxicated, indulging in sensual pleasures. And there is a nice sutta. This is the Majjhima Nikaya 125, the Dantabhumi Sutta, which means the Dantabhumi means like the ground of the tamed, the tamed person, in other words, the stage of the tamed, the point of tamedness, if you like. And that sutta has a... Is it that sutta or is it another sutta? I think it's that sutta. Anyway, there's this nice simile in there, which is very similar to this part, kind of draws a bit more out of this one, adds to this simile, if you like, draws more meaning out of it. And that is a simile of two fellows, they come along, they walk along, right? And then they come to the base of this big hill or this mountain or whatever it is. And then one of these fellows, he walks to the top of the mountain, while the other one, he's too lazy, he kind of stands at the bottom. And then when this other one man, he gets to the top of the mountain, he kind of shouts down to his friend, wow, at the top of the mountain, I can see all these things. I can see fields and villages and parks and meadows. I can, as far as the eye can see, just going on into the horizon. And the fellow at the bottom says, nonsense, there is no way you can see that stuff at the top of the mountain. I don't know where he has lived his whole life, but he is kind of slightly strange. But that's what he says. And then, of course, the other man at the top of the mountain, he says, well, he comes down, grabs him by the hand. Okay, I'm going to show you what is at the top of the mountain. Pulls him up to the top of the mountain and says, well, what do you see? Oh, yeah, I see villages, fields. A bit sheepish at that point. I see exactly what you were saying. And then the other man said, well, how come just a minute ago you were saying this was nonsense? And he said, I was obstructed by this mountain, and that's why I couldn't see anything. And that mountain, of course, is a simile for the five hindrances. When you come out, when you emerge from the jungle, you emerge from the five hindrances for the first time, you get above them, then you get an overview and you can see what is going on. Then you understand what life is really like. You understand the place of that jungle, the place of that grove down there, because you have emerged from it. You get an overview of life and what is happening here. And this is what this is about. And this is what we are trying to do on the spiritual path. We're trying to emerge from those sensual pleasures. We're trying to climb that mountain. And the way to climb that mountain is to go inside of yourself. Abandon these things. Enter a state of samadhi. The samadhi is the spiritual equivalent of that mountain in the physical world. And when you get to samadhi for the first time, then you can understand what sensual pleasures are. Then you have the bird's eye view. Then you are able to look down and see what the world is truly like. That is what samadhi is. Ajahn Brahm has a similar simile in his book, in one of his books, that he talks about his experiences. As a young man, he went to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, or Guatemala, one of those places. I think it's Mexico, actually. And then he goes, climbs this pyramid and comes out of the jungle for the first time. And he said, that's just like what samadhi is like. You're climbing up. You get the bird's eye view of what is going on. And that is what we are trying also to do on the spiritual path. And only then can you really understand what sensual pleasures are like. Only then do these similes here start to make sense. Because now you have a real overview of life. You understand things in the big picture. And you have some perspective of what is going on. So there you are. So these are the Buddha's way of explaining sensual pleasures, the problems with them, why we are trying to kind of eliminate these things a little bit on the Buddhist path. It doesn't mean that we ever abandon all sensual pleasures completely. What it means is that we abandon our craving and attachment to these things. But we're always going to be living in the world of the sensual pleasures. Even the arahant lives in the world of sensual pleasures. Yeah, the arahant is still there. Even when you get into a deep state of samadhi, you can still appreciate your food and appreciate these things. But you do it for the first time without craving, without attachment. It's a very different state of mind that is involved in that particular case. So please consider these things and think about them. And as you consider them, they will most likely have some impact on your life. And then it becomes a natural movement on the spiritual path. Not a forced rejection of things where we use willpower, but a movement that is the result of using wisdom in the right way. And then it's easy. It's natural. It happens as a matter just easily. And this is kind of the ideal on the Buddhist path, for things to happen naturally rather than having a forceful rejection of something, because that just leads to suffering and problems down the road if we do it that way. Okay, so that is all for this morning. So we'll see you again at 3 p.m. this afternoon.